You're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast where we discuss classic works of management and organization studies. We continue episode 60, where we are discussing Joan Woodward's classic book, Industrial Organization Theory and Practice, originally published in 1965. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This is part two of the episode, which we've subtitled The Meaning and Relevance of Contingency Theory. We now rejoin the conversation. So we spent quite a bit of time talking about the book, but we want to start off this part by just getting to the bottom line of, okay, so the result was contingency theory. What is it and what do we make of it, I think is what we should cover first. Anybody have thoughts on that?
Sure. I think kind of the key takeaway from Joan Woodward's work is kind of the central message that organizational structure is not contingent on the types of production technologies, or is contingent on the type of production technologies employed by the firm. So there's not one best organizational structure, but it depends on how a firm set up its production process. And I think that got very nicely illustrated in one of the chapters where she discusses that a company brought in a set of consultants. And this was a kind of a tailor-made small batch production firm. And the consultants came in and they said, you know, you have too much product variety. You have to make too many adaptations to the production process and you need to reduce it. And then the company followed up the advice of the consultants and limited the variety in the productions and went back to their clients and said, you know, like we cannot offer you anymore what you requested of us, but we now have this adapted version for you. Basically, in the end, this resulted in a drastically reduced client base and the firm having to lay off a lot of its long-term employees by following up this advice from the consultants that was based upon, you know, the thinking that there's one best approach for everything, and how over time the company actually went back to their original idea, knowing that because of their client base and the nature of the product they manufactured, they were kind of the small batch type and having custom orders, and they should stick to that.
So not only is there not one best way to manage a production system, there's also not necessarily one best way to consult for a firm with a production system.
I guess you're right there.
Yesterday I saw a video by Steve Jobs talking about consultants. And the point that he raised is that since none of these consultants have implemented what they consult on, they miss crucial elements in learning about the implications of what they're consulting on. So, of course, like when you look from a distance at that kind of company with the small batches, et cetera, and trying to change in between, et cetera, it looks inefficient, but you have to understand, so to say, also the whole, like how all these different parts come together. For example, understanding also the current client relationships, what the client expects, how they will react to these kind of changes. It's an interesting perspective on the role of consultants in these kind of organizational changes, trying to implement the technology change, etc. There are limitations to do that properly. And I think that's one of the examples that Greta just mentioned that nicely show the limitations of consultants. And then it's not, so to say, per se something to blame on consultants. It's also a bit the nature of their job, that they don't see the whole thing through, which makes their perspective always, of course, limited.
Well, the same can also be said of the leaders of the organization itself. If the leader is coming in, say, from outside, and doesn't have a full appreciation for why the firm is operating and functioning the way that it is. And the CEO comes in with a perspective to say that, well, I've taken over this small unit production firm. I used to be in a mass production firm and I was a VP there. And I saw things being done this way and this makes sense to me. And then to try to impose that upon the organization can be a bit chancy. And that even dovetails into some of the cases that Woodward talked about in the third part with the follow-up investigations of some examples, especially of organizations that actually went through a deliberate change to move from, say, one type of production to another, particularly from small batch custom unit production to a mass production, which is typically what you anticipate a lot of firms wanting or needing to do. If they become successful, they move from being small to being large. And then all of a sudden, all of these factors that she brought in the cases start to come into play as, well, this isn't just a matter of just multiplying the size of the organization and things continue to go smoothly. Now you're dealing with the change of dynamics of where the expertise is needed, where development has to occur, the relationships between marketing, development, and production all change in kind, and it can make for some rather bumpy roads.
Yeah, this is interesting because on this part where she talked about the leadership on the organization, that I felt that was something like that person that understands she goes on with the Selznick definition of institutional leadership. So that person who understands the values of the organization and sometimes the product of the organization, this is the person who deals with the contingencies. So the contingencies are important, but to the leadership, it's even more because it's the person who keeps the organization functioning in a way that will cope with the requirements of the technology.
Again, this really got me thinking about my own research. Like, one of the cases I studied within this Japanese multinational was actually a research project. And I followed that over 4 years from the research lab to the large-scale production plant that was built. And following all the transitions, like the innovation, moving out of the lab, going into pilot plants, kind of trying to get proof of products and feasibility of production, and then setting up like the large scale production process. And as I was doing the research during my PhD, I found it so difficult to find literature that is describing this process, as most of the innovation literature looks at the diffusion of innovations rather than scaling up the production process. So I think this is, again, one of the unique aspects of the work here to describe those changes. And indeed, one of the key factors that became highly problematic in the case I studied and that I write about, and that this reading this book made it much clearer to me, is, you know, who is considered an expert, how things should happen, and how this is different when it's, you know, small batch specialized production, which is more characteristic of a pilot plant, versus who is in charge defining the rules of the game in a large-scale production plant, where kind of the rules of the game are stability of production, regularity, not intervening, not making quick changes, which is very different from an innovation context. And how this became problematic as they scaled it up, that too quickly in my study, kind of the rules of the production setting dominated, where the research scientists and the engineers that had helped develop the new production, the new technology, they didn't have enough voice in determining how things happened. Does this make sense?
Yes, it does. And I'd have to go back and look at where Woodward discussed this, but it seemed to me that in a lot of ways, what they were classifying as expert had to do with expertise and longevity within the company, as opposed to so it was sort of like a street smart type of qualification of expert. You had to be in the organization, not just to be smart on your function, but also smart on the context.
Exactly. Yeah.
Whereas now, you know, we're thinking of expertise a little bit differently, and perhaps there's a little bit more that we value in terms of what I might call book smart. Like, you come in to be a master of some domain of knowledge that you're going to bring into the company, and the context doesn't matter as much. You know, it obviously context matters, But in terms of judging who our experts are, you know, you have those who are, you know, we kind of separate them from those who are really expert in some knowledge that we depend upon versus those who are experts in the context, expert experience within the organization. And they might appear in different places.
I completely agree. I think you're touching upon something very important here, is that when small-scale production turns into large-scale production, often the context of where that happens is changing. It's often in a different setting, in a manufacturing company. Like a pilot plant is not a large-scale production site.
An element that I like in this is that we value analysis a lot. We value specialization a lot, that people are really knowledgeable about, so to say, their little small thing. But that an important function in organization is the integration, the synthesis. Like, what does that all mean for us in our situations that we're in right now? What I was sometimes thinking, like, because of course the book is also about change, organizational change, etc., that there's always like this assumption that people don't like change and that change takes time. But if you look at it differently, maybe it's just that people are not, so to say, feeling hurt, as in that there are constraints, that there are situational aspects, contextual aspects that were not taken into account by management in making certain decisions. And that this integration role, this synthesis role, is undervalued. And that's, of course, you know, the links, of course, back to ideas like division of labor, etc., that Taylor had introduced. And that at the same time, what Taylor was talking about as well, is like the idea that at the end, everybody should be responsible together. But without the shared responsibility, then who's actually interested in the integration? Everybody, so to say, has their own little perspective on things. That's, I guess, also what the kind of thing that that Mary Park Follett was talking about. It's so important to see things holistically and try to combine the different perspectives that are out there. And that is also to say, comes back into the way that things are organized, the way that functions are created, designed, etc.
Yeah, you bring up an excellent point, and it sort of reminds me of some of the trends that we see nowadays that are perhaps departing from the firms that that Woodward studied. Because the firms that she studied, in essence, all of the functions, marketing, development, and production, and everything associated with it, were all sort of self-contained within the one organization. Now, to a certain extent, we're starting to see, we're seeing a greater tendency to sort of parcel those functions out in a way such that, like, for example, production. We've seen movements where, the production function is not necessarily done in-house, in that it's not at the same level as the headquarters, but it might be outsourced or contingent on, let's say that, all right, I'm going to set up my production in a place where I can get the cheapest labor possible. So I'll set up the production in this location. And then when it turns out that I can get it done more cheaply somewhere else, then I'll either subcontract or I'll move the factory. And so the three functions that in Woodward's time were all sort of within the same, not necessarily same building, but same campus or same organizational boundary, there's more of a tendency now to look at those three functions as being, you know, outsourceable. And the organization can choose to, you know, to basically be somewhat divorced from it, which even further changes the dynamics of where the expertise lies and what you think about the value of participation. Are you going to be concerned about the participation or the views of factory workers in the place where you can say, all right, we're going to just close that factory down and move somewhere else?
Completely true. And I think this is something we have seen in the past 4 to 5 decades, as, you know, information technology improved, globalization was happening, and in today's economy, neoliberalism, capitalism, where, you know, bottom line becomes more and more important in determining how operations within the firm happen, which is, I guess, a very different climate than the climate or environment that the firms that were included in the study found themselves in.
Just to mention that here in Brazil, we have this process of bringing to our territory many industries that was traditional from Europe and the United States. And now we can say that these industries are going away, these manufacturers, sorry. So this is the process that are going to be is very well consolidated here because of the global value chains and so on. So the challenge here is now it's to understand how to retain these manufacturing plants and how to make it useful for other kinds of production, especially because here our industrial sector are very populated by automotive manufacturers. So the challenge is to make some kind of movement like Woodward are telling us that to go when she's talking about the companies moving to unit to large batch and to process to large batch. So we are here in a kind of and we're seeing with the development of the industry, we are seeing manufacturing going out of the large batch and going to unit and process production. And this is something interesting because she's saying that right at the beginning of the book that in the future, every manufacturer will be unit production. This is kind of a futurologist thing in the book that interests.
Can we take the example of beer brewing? Maybe this is a nice illustration of that point, actually, where we see that, the small manufacturers of small breweries are actually peaking at this time period where we see a lot of custom-made small brands rather than the large production that is thriving at the moment. What do you think?
I think that's an excellent example of sort of a trend that, at least on the surface, appears to be going in the opposite direction of what the firms Woodward was looking at. Because indeed, there's one of the things I find just kind of fascinating is that we don't like average things. You know, I mean, there's it's very easy to appeal to individualized tastes and to be able to promote small batches, especially in beer, where there is such a history of diversity of styles and products. On the other hand, you know, one of the things I find interesting about that particular example is that if you actually do go around and sample enough of these products, you find out that they're actually a lot more similar than perhaps they're advertised. There's there's a lot of emphasis on uniqueness, and yet the products, you know, like a lot of the firms that crop up, they're either following the English beer paradigm, which is ales. They all have their version of pale ale, IPA, or whatever. And then you have others which are sort of follow the German or the European lead, and it'll be pils and lagers, and there's a lot of similarities. So even though, the firms themselves are getting smaller, there are breweries that we have in the United States who are contracting with a lot of these smaller breweries to help with producing the same brand and making it more available. So there's, in a way, there's some flexibility, shall we say, in the way you define yourself as, based on the type and the scope of the firm.
Yeah, I agree there. And I think we're now starting to reason in contingency firms where, the environment is important in determining how the organization is structured, how it is organized. Well, when we think about manufacturing, how the manufacturing process looks like and how that can change in different time periods where there are kind of different rules in the market at play.
And it's interesting when you see how manufacturing are evolving, how industrial policies are around the world are dealing with this thing, is that you can achieve some kind of mass customization of their products using big data, so you can predict demand. So one of the contingencies that Woodward are talking about, that, for example, market size or demand, simply demand can be challenged, can be overcome. So it's interesting because I think she got this intuition, let's say this way, back in the 58, and now it's something that's becoming a kind of a reality for some companies.
There's another example of an industry that I think might be worth shipbuilding. When we talk about mass production, unit production, those sorts of things, we might be thinking of small items, perhaps as a sort of a default, things there, you can find tangibly coming off of the assembly line, and you would find it in the store, and that sort of thing. But shipbuilding it's got to be an interesting contingency all its own, simply because of the size and the complexity of each individual unit. And when we're talking about a ship, we're talking about building. I don't know how long they take necessarily. I know how long it takes to build a military ship, which is a really huge system. There, there's a lot to the manufacturing of all of the components of the system. Where's the one bottleneck? Where is the thing that that could possibly go wrong that would prevent, say, being able to produce one ship over the course of a 6-month period? And the pressure of being able to deliver that ship on time to a customer, because we're talking about potentially hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars per unit. It almost sounds like it has a lot of a process character to it, to me, it sounds like, because the, to shut down the production line would be like just unbelievably devastating. You just couldn't afford to do it, because if you don't sell that one ship, you're in trouble, right?
Completely agree. And I think another complexity added to that is how a lot of that work is also subcontracted to other organizations that build part of that ship. For instance, the communication technology, or maybe the engine is produced by a certain company. Some of the furniture is produced by another company. And so, this kind of modularization of the process, separating things being produced by different organizational actors, but in the end having to be integrated again.
Oh yeah. And it also, the importance of the engineering and the planning functions in that get significant, because depending on the nature of the platform, you're trying to add more and more capability into these vessels, and yet you're confined with space. Like if you're trying to add a whole bunch of new information technology equipment, and let's say, maybe not a ship, but an airplane, a large airplane. Obviously, there's only so much space, and weight becomes a consideration. And the expertise and the knowledge and the control over the process, trying to keep everything together so that the airplane or the ship comes off the assembly line ready to go, is very, very complex. And you're right. Subcontracting for some of the components is a big part of it. Doing so induces a lot of risk as well, if your subcontractor isn't reliable.
Wasn't the example of Boeing so interesting, where they the Dreamliner was that, where they tried to outsource a lot of aspects of the airplane design as well to all the suppliers. And then when they were trying to integrate it later, it didn't work, because from a design perspective, they hadn't thought that through, that if you create all these organizational barriers during the design process by giving different companies different parts to supply, that even though you might save costs by having a specialized company design a specific part and produce it in the end, that at the end, the integration becomes so complex. And that especially if you design these big kind of objects with so much complexity, so much independence between all these different parts, that you need to think about integration throughout the design process much more, and can't just plan out the designing and the building, etc., of the plane, but that you need to much more consciously think about how to integrate all the different elements from all the different suppliers.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. perhaps there were assumptions that by outsourcing you could manage your risk, only to discover that, well, actually you can't. Ultimately, the risk, if you do the outsourcing, well, you don't necessarily pass the risk on. There's maybe different risks that the subcontractor might take, like that perhaps being dependent upon the client company for their business. But ultimately, no matter what you do, you're still liable for the end product as the main production firm. Is that, you know, is that a fair statement? And if so, then what do we make of, say, like, how would we use Woodward's work to try to inform how we make better decisions about when to keep things in-house, when to outsource, when to make these sort of big decisions about that may change the way we're doing our business?
And I think, like, moving that one level up, thinking about, you know, how org theory or industrial sociology at the time has developed. So at the end of the book, Joan Woodward kind of makes this argument about, you know, she refers to Scott's 1961 work on how theories evolve. And that's on page 249 for those who are interested in a new area, how often discovery starts and leads to the formulation of general laws and then leads to variation observed and laws or theories becoming a little bit more smaller, maybe not very macro, but mid-range, having these contingencies, and how later on, you know, you find a way to synthesize all the different things you find. And when you now think about, you know, what can we learn from this book about why do we do the research we do? And kind of a discussion I had with Leonardo as we prepared for this podcast about, you know, what type of research is actually needed to come to that type of theorizing. And, you know, the uniqueness of this study, and Leonardo mentioned, like, I'm not sure if we're able to do this type of research anymore, you know, like starting off with 200 companies. First of all, how do you get 200 companies, manufacturing or maybe technology companies that are more important nowadays, to be involved in your study, to wanting to take part? And then if you do so, like, how are you able to get the funding to hire the people to spend a week inside those firms? And how do you get the people inside those firms willing to talk to these researchers and spend a week of their time answering all their questions? Yeah, are we still able to do this type of work, which obviously is so important to inform our theorizing and to understand, you know, if we think about the portfolio of theories about organizations we have nowadays and the theories about management and leadership and which ones are true for what situation and how that changes over time, what implications can we learn about the research we should be doing, the types of funding we should be getting in order to execute that, and the current academic, but also the business environment that the companies we're interested in find themselves.
What I've learned from this book, I think it's something I want to mention, is that the importance of understand how technology can help your organization. Because now I think we're seeing maybe some parallels with the Woodward context, because every new technology is selling, is say that they can help your organization achieve better results, or that you have to implement digital technologies on your routines. And what she brought to us was that the importance of the leadership to understand how this could be applied on your organization. So this is something that is still important, and I think it's not so people don't pay attention at it, because we are seeing this discussion that every organization is passing through a digital transformation, but we don't know exactly what it is and how it's done and how you can make your organization be able to grab benefits of it. So And we are seeing many research influenced by Woodward, showing how organizations adapt the use of technologies to their context. So there is no one better way to introduce a technology on your organization. And there are several ways, and this, I think, is very important.
I wanted to pick up Greta's point from before. I think what I keep thinking as I'm in academia, that we split, we have this artificial split also in our own organizations, that we split education from research, that we split valorization from research and education, and that I see like there's so much potential to combine all three. So I'm thinking like about how many of the famous books that we look at, they come out of lectures giving. So as an example, now I'm thinking about Dewey's work, that he would give a lecture on some aspects of his work. And then out of that would come a book. So that you see, so to say, your role as an academic to also be in public, to speak to public, to make lectures that are impactful, and that you also, for example, see a role as being in touch with companies out there, so that maybe not tuna companies, but that people know your work, that people know you, and that you already have an established relationship built with the companies to have the kind of rapport to be able to do this kind of research. If no one knows you and you don't happen to work at a very famous university, then it's going to be, of course, very tricky. But I think that the point that I take from this is that it's very important to have these kind of relationships with companies, with practice, to be able to do this kind of research. But I think that requires maybe a different kind of scholarship than is easily done in today's system.
As I said, I think the book shows us many ways how to think about the implementation of technology inside organizations. I missed how the decisions were made, especially because by the time that there was already discussion about it, especially the work of Herbert Simon. I think Simon is mentioned just like theory that she, I think, could be more dialogue there. But the main idea that there is no best way to organize, for instance, is something that is still relevant, because today I think we are facing another wave of optimism about how technology can improve your performance without asking how this can be done.
I think another takeaway I had from reading the book is, you know, the value of deep, real, sustained engagement in the field, and how that allows you to not only contribute to the development of organizational theory, to make your theoretical contribution and show some novelty there, but also really have a practical impact in the field. And, you know, the alignment of those two objectives, which sometimes is like a point of debate nowadays within the broader academia. And also thinking of, you know, what can we learn from that? What Friedhoff said about the importance of writing books, the importance of being able to tell your story and not being confined to, you know, the 40 pages of a journal article. But also, like, you know, thinking about funding, thinking about how much time do we actually allow PhD students to spend in the field. Here in the UK, a PhD is usually 3 years. You cannot do this type of research anymore during your PhD. And when you're in a tenure track position and having loads of teaching going on, it's also very difficult to do this type of research. I think it's also like it reminds us of the importance of creating those spaces to have a group of researchers that are like-minded, have a similar approach, and doing this large-scale research combining breadth with depth, and the power of that combination in revealing insights that are groundbreaking.
And that's I wholly agree on both points. So thank you very much. This was a tremendous conversation. And again, Leonardo, thank you for joining the podcast.
Thank you all.
And that concludes episode 60. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook,
or through our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Please join us again as we discuss another classic work from organization theory and management science here on Talking About Organizations.